Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Today we take a journey. It may be a dangerous journey, and once we go out the door and step in the road, if we don't keep our feet, there is no knowing where we will be swept off to. Those words are a paraphrased version of a speech that Bilbo Baggins gave to Frodo in the ever-popular fantasy novel, The Hobbit. With the Hobbit movie soon to be released in theaters around the world, I thought it'd be fun to dip into the supernatural world that is Middle-earth and see what it might tell us about our own spiritual lives. I will admit from the outset here that I have never read The Hobbit or any of the other J.R.R. Tolkien fantasy novels or short stories. However, I did see the various movies associated with the Lord of the Rings trilogy at my family's urging, but would not in any way call myself a fan of that series. Fortunately, I was able to locate somebody who is extremely knowledgeable of this material, and he has agreed to sit down and school me in the finer points of this classic fantasy fiction. That person is Dr. Corey Olson, an assistant professor of English at Washington College in the bucolic village of Chestertown, Maryland. Professor Olson is the author of Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit, a book we will link to on our website, so please go and visit it. Professor Olson is also endearingly known as the Tolkien Professor because of his deep knowledge about all things Middle-earth and then some. In his capacity as the Tolkien Professor, he operates the Mythgard Institute, a website that aggregates a great deal of scholarship on Tolkien from a variety of sources, as well as serving as a place for students to explore their love of this fantasy genre. Corey, a hearty welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I don't have a name like the Tolkien Professor. Usually I'm known as the curmudgeon or the grumpy professor. You got a kind of a cool name. How did you come to be known as the Tolkien Professor? Was that name given to you, or did you kind of brand yourself as that?
Well, it was really the latter. Basically, it just started off as my URL. When I started my podcast, I first conceived it back in 2007. And then I kind of left it aside for a couple years because I got swept up in other things, and then I came back to it in 2009, and that's when it really sort of launched in earnest. But basically, when I first was starting out, I was looking for some. I couldn't figure out what to call the website, and I was like, you know, this is a big deal. You know, I mean, like, what the website is called, what the URL address is gonna really. I agonized over it, and finally, TolkienProfessor.com came to me because it was descriptive. You know, it's like, well, I'm talking about Tolkien, and I am a professor who is talking about Tolkien, so that's what I would call it. So I called the podcast The Tolkien Professor, which, as it was really just designed to kind of be descriptive in that way, but it has kind of taken off, and people refer to me as that. I have to admit that I find it somewhat embarrassing, because of course I certainly don't mean to imply that I'm the only professor on Tolkien, or, you know, that I am in some sense the Tolkien Professor. You know, there are very many scholars and professors out there whom I respect very much and hold in very high regard. But as far as a label, it has been clear and effective. So I've been happy with it, though sometimes shy about it.
No, that's great. That's how I found you, because I was looking for somebody to talk about The Hobbit. I know this is going to be a big deal, and you know it's something lighthearted that I want to talk a bit about on our show, and a little bit different than some of the other themes that we talk about. So it's pretty cool that you laid your flags down on the World Wide Web to that thing. Yeah, which is very cool. So you probably get a lot of people coming to you asking lots of questions because, you know, you got that URL that says you're the guy, right?
Well, yeah, and actually it's been great. I mean, that's been something that has been, to me, just very remarkable. The podcast from when I sort of relaunched in 2009 on iTunes just really exploded. I mean, the whole point of it was that I was publishing stuff. I mean, I was an untenured professor publishing stuff. And then there just came a time when I was like, look, you know, there are lots of people out there who like Tolkien, and you know, nobody can read these scholarly publications I'm submitting to. Why don't I just put it out? You know, I'll just make a website, do a podcast. I'll just put it out there because I think people would be interested. And that turned out to be true.
And so is that what the Mythgard Institute is all about?
Basically, the Mythgard Institute is an extension of that.
Okay.
Once I did the podcast, and, you know, I've had in the last 3 years over 3 million downloads of my episodes and podcast materials. Basically, it was clear that there was a really thriving audience out there, and not just that there was an audience, but there are a lot of people who are really hungry for this kind of thing. There are so many people who are not connected to academia, who have no access to a research library, you know, even who geographically can't get close to a school, and who would really like to study more, to learn more, to be involved in intellectual discussion. And there seemed to be really, really a desire for that. So I founded Mythgard as it's a purely online institution, but it's an online institution that really takes a different approach to teaching, or that is, rather, its focus is on teaching. That is, all of our classes are live and interactive. We have live audio, video streaming feeds of the lecturers and who are, you know, taking questions and responding to students in class. So it provides an opportunity for people around the world, and we have people from almost every continent, who can take the classes and interact with some of the greatest scholars of, you know, in their fields in the world. We've got some of the top Tolkien scholars everywhere teaching classes on Tolkien. We've got classes now on science fiction. We're expanding outwards into other literatures, and we're offering language classes and stuff. It's been really great.
Yeah, it is a really neat resource to go and look, and it's extremely well organized too. There's a lot of websites that are not very well organized, but this one is a great one. We're going to point our listeners to this if you want to learn more about this stuff. But I heartily agree with what you're doing. I mean, this is the whole purpose of doing our podcast, your research on religion, is that there are a lot of people, very smart people, that want to hear this stuff, but the walls of academia just seem to be impenetrable in many ways. And so this is a way of really opening up that world to a lot more people.
Absolutely. No, that's been my goal from the beginning. Once the podcast started to succeed and I began to see how many people were out there, it became, you know, basically a greater and greater conviction of mine to, mm-hmm. exactly to do that, to open the doors, to be able to allow people access to stuff. You know, and like for Mythgard, you know, we do charge for our classes because, you know, teachers work hard and need to be paid for
right.
what they do.
Yeah, us economists know that, so.
Exactly. So I do charge for, but again, there, you know, the goal there is, you know, to keep the tuition as low as is possible, and the online environment allows us to keep our overhead quite low as well. So that works out really well. I'm really excited about that. And no, it has been so rewarding to be involved in that process and really being able to grant people access and bring people together from literally around the world. I mean, I'll be doing a class where I have students live from all over America, from Europe, from Japan, from Australia, New Zealand, you know, all live with me in class. It's really cool.
Oh, that is really neat. Let me dip into your past a little bit before we get into Tolkien's past. How did you become entranced with Tolkien's writing? Was this something that you developed when you were a young kid or something that came to you later in life?
Yeah, it was. It was. I first read The Hobbit when I was 8. I was just given a copy of it by a cousin of mine who thought I would like it. I actually had read The Chronicles of Narnia first. The Chronicles of Narnia were read to me by my parents. My parents were C.S. Lewis fans, but they didn't really know Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd already read me The Chronicles of Narnia, and I loved it. And I think that that's why my cousin gave me The Hobbit, because, you know, on the principle that if I liked The Chronicles of Narnia so much, I'd like this too. And he was right, and I loved it. And, you know, I quickly found The Lord of the Rings and read that, and I've been reading them and rereading the books ever since. So it stretches back a long ways for me.
That's
hard for me to remember a time before I was really immersed in.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's impressive that you read the book when you were 8. I mean, that is like, wow, because it's a difficult work to get through. I mean, you can read it at one level, it's kind of a fun fantasy novel, but there's just a lot of other things going on there. So very, very impressive. One thing that's curious that I have, and this is something for you folks in the humanities, for me in the social sciences, it's a little bit different, but you guys seem to read the books over and over and over again. I mean, I'll give one or two classic books a one or two read through, but that's about it. I'm usually done with them then. So is it pretty common in your field to read these things in depth for a long time?
Yes, it is fairly. I mean, I find that I can't really, I can't really comment. I can't do the kind of reading of a work that I would want to do. In fact, I barely feel even qualified to talk about a book if I've only read it once.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even a book that I'm not really fond of, like, for instance, you know, there's been a, you know, my relationship with the Harry Potter series, let me give as an illustration. I've never been an enormous Harry Potter fan. I don't strongly dislike them, but I'm not a fan. But it's something that comes up with me all the time. I mean, I'm the guy who teaches on fantasy, so all my students always want to talk about Harry Potter with me. So I've gone back and read them. I'm just now in book 7, finishing reading the series through for the fourth time. Not because I love it and I'm a huge fan, but because I'm still trying to make sure I get it. You know, and I'm still trying to inform myself about, you know, what I have to say about it and to make sure that I'm understanding things. And that, for me, is just really necessary. I have to really kind of have a book in my head, not memorized, of course, but I have to really be able to have it in my head to make sure that I'm really putting things together. Because it's so easy when you're analyzing literature to just kind of go off very quickly, you're just kind of doing autobiography rather than, or making stuff up rather than actually talking about the book. You've really got to be rooted in the text itself and make sure that what you're saying really fits, not just as sort of, you know, a tangential line off of a particular passage in the book,
mm-hmm.
which I think, you know, many readers can be kind of guilty of. I read this in the book, and that made me think about that, and that made me think about this other thing, and so here's this conclusion I've drawn, but actually it...
And then you project it backwards. Yeah. Is it difficult ever, you know, when you're reading through it the second or third or fourth or fifth time, it becomes a slog? Because, I mean, you know the ending then.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I am not a big... I never am particularly troubled about spoilers.
Okay.
I'm not the kind of person who reads the last chapter first, necessarily. When I'm reading a book for the first time, you know, part of the experience is to sort of see how the author is kind of handling the unfolding of information, so I do kind of like to learn about it as I go along. But I am fairly strongly of the opinion that if having what happens later on in the story spoils it for you, if you can't enjoy the book thereafter, that is by definition a bad book. I mean, like, that means it doesn't stand up. If it doesn't stand up to a second reading, if it's not interesting the second time you read it, that is my, like, absolute qualification of, like, a book that was not really worth reading the first time.
That's really interesting. There are a number of books that in the social sciences I've read through a couple times as before. And, you know, I read stuff on the French Revolution. I do know how it comes out, but some of the books that I read there are still pretty good, and I do go through. So that's an interesting take on that. Hey, let's go ahead and dig into this guy, J.R.R. Tolkien. Did you do your dissertation on this guy at Columbia University? Was that what you were focused on? You did not?
I didn't, actually. No, my PhD is in medieval literature, and I actually studied and wrote on Tolkien not at all during my entire graduate career. I didn't touch him or write on him or talk about him even barely at all. I was a pure medievalist. That's what I went to school for, and that's what I did. And, you know, in part this was because I was in the medieval literature program. There wasn't anybody at Columbia who did Tolkien, so I was never, like, drawn out and tempted to go there. And if you had asked me then, you know, when I was in my PhD program, I would never... If you had asked me then, like, you know, what will you spend most of the rest of your life doing your scholarly work on, I would never have said, well, Tolkien, of course. That's not where I thought my career was going. Now, if you had told me then that later on I would be publishing books on Tolkien and lecturing on Tolkien and founding an online institute for the study of Tolkien and fantasy literature, if you had told me that, then I would have been delighted, but I would have been surprised.
Yeah. No, it's interesting how our life takes these twists and turns in that. And I'm sure that some of your knowledge of medieval literature does help to inform some of your thinking about Tolkien and stuff.
Oh, it does. And in fact, I would also say the other way around, that basically I blame Tolkien for my becoming a medievalist in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I went to college, I was very interested to take medieval literature. And as soon as I did take medieval literature, I loved it. I'd already read a little bit of it, or at least what I thought was medieval literature. In retrospect, the stuff that I found in high school was mostly, like, pretty bad modern editions of stuff. But I was trying at my little public library. And when I was, you know, finally really reading medieval stuff, it didn't seem strange. It just felt so natural. It felt like coming home. And I blame Tolkien for that. I mean, the problem that most readers, in my experience teaching medieval lit, which is which is in fact what I was hired to do at Washington College and what I have been doing there for 9 years now. When I teach medieval lit, the biggest challenge with students is getting them over that sense of strangeness. The medieval is just weird. I mean, from a modern perspective,
yeah.
They look at things so differently than we do, and I don't just mean their beliefs and their worldview, though the differences there are quite profound, even more profound than people assume. That is, I know there are a lot of modern people who sort of look back at the Middle Ages and think, well, okay, that was like, you know, that was a very Christian age. So, like, the main difference is that everybody believes in Christianity. Basically, I think that people have this general, like, sometimes make this kind of vague assumption that the beliefs that people had in the Middle Ages were, like, vaguely similar to, you know, people who live in the Bible Belt in America or something like that. And it's just, I mean, yes, it's true that Christianity informed a great many of their everyday beliefs and actions and everything else, but the differences of how they looked at the world and how they thought things worked is that's only really the tip of the iceberg. So the result is that their stories are weird. I mean, they unfold weirdly. Their whole narrative approach, the assumptions of what people are expecting when they read a story are so different that modern readers just have a really hard time getting into it. And it's the biggest obstacle to be overcome when you're teaching medieval lit to modern college students. Well, you know, Tolkien helps with that because Tolkien has much in common with medieval literature, but does not have that strangeness. It's something that modern readers, at least many modern readers, really can enter into right away. And I really do think that my immersion in Tolkien is, first of all, one of the things that made me interested in pursuing more medieval literature to begin with, and then secondly, made me feel so much at home when I finally got there.
Well, tell me a little bit about this Tolkien guy, and you know, he's a more contemporary writer,
yeah.
And he's also a contemporary of C.S. Lewis. And you mentioned earlier on that you had read the Chronicles of Narnia first, or your parents had read them to you, and so there's this relationship that you have between the two books. I understand vaguely that Tolkien was at Oxford roughly at the same time that C.S. Lewis was. Were they buddies or anything?
Oh yes, they were buddies. They were friends. It's interesting, sort of academically, they were on different sides of the fence. And the fence I'm talking about is the heated academic debates in the English faculty of Oxford at that period, where there was this academic war being waged between the philologists and the literary guys, you know, the lit people and the lying people. And they were sort of fighting about the primacy of their fields and how the syllabi would be designed and all of these things. And C.S. Lewis was a lit guy, and Tolkien was a lying guy. And so, sort of officially, politically, they were enemies. You know, so in some ways, they kind of, you know, they sort of shouldn't have become buddies. Lewis jokes about this in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, where when he talks about Tolkien and meeting Tolkien, and he said that he had been told implicitly since his childhood not to trust a Catholic. He had been given to believe that without being instructed formally. He had been given to understand that he shouldn't trust a Catholic, and since he had come to Oxford, he'd been told explicitly not to trust a philologist. And Tolkien was both, and yet the two of them got all, you know, what they shared. What the two of them shared in common was not Christianity, because Lewis was still not a Christian yet at that time that they met. But what they shared was a love for Germanic mythology. They both loved Norse stuff and Germanic stuff. And they formed a group together. Tolkien formed a group that he invited Lewis to, which was called the Kolbitar, the coal biters, literally, meaning like people who sit really close to the fire. And what they did was they got together and read through Old Norse sagas together, like once a week. Tolkien was trying to convert people into reading more Old Norse stuff, in Old Norse, of course, that it wasn't a very difficult language, and they could easily do it if they worked on it together. And so that's how the two of them met and first came to be associated. And later they became closer friends, and the two of them, especially Lewis, but Tolkien was involved from the beginning, formed the famous group of friends and writers who used to get together and talk every week down at their favorite pub, the Eagle and Child, called the Inklings.
Ah. Well, let me, before we get to talk about Lewis a little bit more, I think we skated over a little bit where Tolkien gets his inspiration from.
I mean,
a lot of kids might be interested in Norse mythology because, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff involved in it. Tell us a little bit about Tolkien's background and how he became enchanted with this worldview or this view of the world in Norse mythology.
Well, they're basically sort of, I mean, any statements like this, of course, are necessarily reductive, but there are three really important things about Tolkien's background that I think are important to understand if you want to kind of understand his inspiration in those ways. One is his Catholicism. He was a Roman Catholic, and he was a Roman Catholic at a time when it was not necessarily easy to be a Roman Catholic. In fact, his family, he was raised by his mother. His father died when he was very young. He was one when his father died, and he was born in South Africa, and he and his mother and his brother moved back to England, and his father died while they were up there, and they never returned to South Africa. His mother raised him Catholic and was cut off by Tolkien's father's family, by her deceased husband's family, at the choice to raise the boys Catholic. So this was always an important thing to him. It was something that actually caused some tension in his married life. His wife converted to Catholicism, but was not always really comfortable with it. And yet, nevertheless, it remains throughout his life a very important and stable fact of his life. So one thing to keep in mind is his Catholicism. The second thing to keep in mind is his love of languages. That is one of the other things that always drove him. He loved language. He was professionally a philologist. People call him an English professor, but when Americans especially call him that, they are picturing a literature professor. He was not. He would have been offended had he been called a literature professor. He was a linguist. He was a philologist. He studied the history of language. And, of course, he talked about and discussed literature in that context. He was one of the greatest scholars of Beowulf, who has ever lived and still wrote an essay which remains to this day the most influential essay ever written on Beowulf, called Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics. He did translations of wonderful both Middle English and Anglo-Saxon poems. His work, again, from an American perspective, looks like the work of a literature professor, but he was a philologist. He studied language, and he was always moved by language.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, you can kind of see this in his work, because he does play a lot with words and combines words and changes words and makes different, he creates his own language, in essence.
Oh, absolutely, yes. He invented a number of languages, actually. Over the course of his life, he invented six or seven imagined languages. And we're talking complete grammars and phonetic structures, and not only complete grammars and phonetic structures, but philological histories. So, for instance, he invented an elven language, a language for the elves to speak, and he invented a second language for the elves to speak, and then he invented a linguistic history whereby these two languages had originally come from a different stem language, but then varied into regional dialectical differences, which eventually became pronounced into these two different variants, which could then be considered different languages. And having invented this entire philological history of the two languages of the elves, he figured that he needed to figure out a story that would explain the history of these two different languages and why those two languages split off and why these two elven languages had this history that they did. And that's where his stories of the Silmarillion came from. In large part, that history of these languages that he had invented is the origin of all of the Middle-earth stories.
Wow. I just to think about somebody conceptualizing this in their head and putting not just one story about a hobbit together, but a whole world that has interconnections is just amazing.
Oh, yeah.
The intellectual power of that. Hey, what's the third thing that you thought of in Tolkien's background?
The third thing is the one that I mentioned previously, which is his love for mythology. And he understood mythology. I should define a term here. For him, the word myth and mythology meant a great deal more than it tends to mean now. We use the word myth in what Tolkien would consider an almost impossibly cheapened way. That is, in the sense of like the TV show Mythbusters, right? That, you know, you say, oh, that's a myth, by which we mean something that isn't true. Or more specifically, something that many people believe, but which is not really true, is how we tend to use the word myth. And Tolkien would have found that usage of the word myth appalling. It is certainly true that that a myth is a story in which people believe. But he believed that myths were very important and very powerful. Now, keep in mind all the things I'm about to say about Tolkien's relationship to mythology. This is why I led with his Catholicism, which was unwavering. And this was, you know, so this is, there's, you know, he starts this from a premise which was, you know, going back through to his childhood with a firm grounding in a Catholic faith. Now, having said that, he looks at these mythologies and he says, these stories, these myths of these ancient peoples, and in particular, he was moved less by things like Greek mythology and much more by the Norse mythology and the Germanic mythology. So yeah, you can keep Hercules, give him Sigurd Fafnir's bane, and that's where Tolkien lived. And in reading these stories, he would say there is something more to these stories. These stories get at, there's a reason that people invested belief in these stories. There's a reason that these stories were so meaningful. Are they true? Well, what does that mean? Are they true in the sense of being accurate as one would hope a historical chronicle might be accurate? No, they're not designed to be history. That's not the kind of story that they are. That's not what they're even attempting to do. So to say, oh, this story is inaccurate, is simply to misread it or wholly to misunderstand or miscontextualize it. So then, how can one answer that question? Is this story true? He would say with the great myths, you know, there is, in fact, some truth. There is something that these myths get to. There's a reason these stories are powerful themselves. There are a reason that these stories had this influence on people. A reason these stories were invested in by people. Because, in fact, they do get at something. There is something mythic in this idea. Even in stories like, say, Beowulf. And, you know, when Beowulf, you know, lies in wait and grapples with Grendel in the darkness, there is a mythic force to that story. It touches on something, something profound, something beyond the actual history of what may or may not have happened in the hall called Heorot, but something which touches something far more profound. And that idea of myth as a story which sort of touches truth, is hugely important in Tolkien's idea. He wanted to write mythology. And that is not in the sense of creating an alternative religion or something like that, not in the sense of, again, sort of describing something historically that occurred, but in the sense of invoking these ideas. And I will say, I think that Tolkien succeeded in this as profoundly as any author in the entire 20th century. This is my answer. It's a hard answer to get to, especially if I'm doing like a 15-minute radio interview, and people ask me, what do you think gives Tolkien's works their lasting appeal, which is a question I'm often asked. But this is the heart of my answer to the question, is that he wrote mythology. He achieved the writing of myth. Gandalf standing on the bridge of Khazad-dûm, facing the Balrog and saying, "You shall not pass." That is a mythic moment. And even things which are less dramatic, things like the Ents and the loss of the Entwives. Now, if you haven't read the book and you've only seen the movie, you won't get this because the Ents are horrible in the films. They're one of my worst. They're one of my least favorite parts of Peter Jackson's film. But in the book, the Ents tell Merry and Pippin, Treebeard tells Merry and Pippin the story about how the Ents lost the Entwives, that there were the females of their species, and that, as Treebeard says, their hearts did not go on growing in the same way, and they kind of separated. The Entwives went over to one place, and they started, because they were more into cultivated fields and fruited trees and things, and the Ents were about the wild forest. Mm-hmm. And so the Ents stayed in their forest, and the Entwives went out into their field. And then they were separated over time, and war rolled across the Entwives' fields and destroyed them. And then the Ents were searching for them and couldn't find them. They don't know whether the Entwives still exist or whether they've all died. And they have spent the last 1,000 years or so, several thousand years, searching and calling for the Endwives and hoping to find them. And even just like this, the idea of, you know, again, what he does with the Ensign, the story of the Ensign, the Endwives, and the loss of the Endwives, it's a small thing. It's totally inconsequential to the plot of the story, but it's a deeply moving moment. It's a mythic concept, and again, his story has this power. These sort of mythic moments peek through lots of times in Tolkien's books. So again, this idea of the power of myth, and I would add, by the way, that this Tolkien's concept of mythology is actually one of the things that led directly to C.S. Lewis's conversion to Christianity. A lot of people don't know this story.
Yeah, I want to ask that because there's this interesting contrast. So they're hanging out at this pub, they're the Inklings, they're reading different things together, and Tolkien is really in a completely different mythic world. I mean, he's creating a world from scratch, whereas C.S. Lewis, it seems like a lot of his writings are reinterpreting biblical stories through his stories, the lion and all that kind of stuff. So could you give us what are the differences and similarities between those two authors?
Well, the main thing that they have in common is their idea of myth. See, one thing that a lot of people overlook, Aslan looms so large, you know, and the obvious, in fact, the manifest, the foundational connection between Aslan and Jesus is, you know, so occupies the minds of so many readers that they overlook the fact that everything else in the Chronicles of Narnia is constructed from pagan mythology, like Tolkien was working with as well. Lewis completely agreed with Tolkien about myth. That was one of the deepest things that they had in common. And as I just mentioned, and I'll come back to the Chronicles of Narnia in a second, as I just mentioned, it was instrumental in Lewis's conversion. Lewis had become a theist. He had come to believe that God existed, but he was not yet a Christian. What he did not accept was the idea that this historical person called Jesus of Nazareth, who lived 2,000 years ago, could possibly have any relevance to the people who came afterwards. Like, okay, so there was this dude named Jesus who lived and was a great teacher and did these great things. What does it matter? And what came to weigh on him was the connection to mythology, the fact that he knew that, in fact, there were lots of myths about the dying god. There was, you know, myths like the myth of Osiris in Egyptian mythology, even more powerfully and more powerful and evocative to both Tolkien and to Lewis was the myth of Baldur from Norse mythology. Again, another dying god whose death brings life, Lewis could see that the story of Jesus and his death and resurrection seemed to be another instance of this, and Lewis and Tolkien had a famous conversation about this one evening, and what Tolkien was saying is that the difference is, you know, Lewis was saying, what's the difference between, you know, this story about Jesus and this story about Baldur or about Osiris or about Adonis? And Tolkien says, in this instance, like, yes, it is connected to all those myths, but in Jesus, myth became fact. Myth, and for the first time, this concept which had been pointed to mythically by all of these old stories became reality, entered history, and actually changed things. And Lewis could get that. Lewis could appreciate that. And the next morning, he wrote a letter to his brother Warney and said, now I believe I will have to be a Christian. So this idea of myth and the power of myth was really important to both of them. And you can see that in the Chronicles of Narnia. The Chronicles of Narnia are not really just, they're not just designed to illustrate Bible stories or something like that. What they do is they are, the word Lewis used for it was a supposition. And suppose we have a world in which the Son of God is incarnated, not in the form of a human being, but enters into that world in a different way. So he's incarnated as a beast among these other talking beasts. So he's the lion. Supposing that happened, what would it look like? And the Chronicles of Narnia follow. So it's not really like he's drawing specific parallels to particular biblical stories. Of course, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know, Aslan dies and rises again, not because he's trying to, like, do the crucifixion exactly, but because he believed if the Son of God is incarnated in a different world, well, this is what is going to happen to him, and this is how he's going to respond. And yes, it's going to look like what happened in the Gospels. And that's not a coincidence, of course, but it's also not exactly just, it's certainly not an allegory in the way people use the word allegory a lot to talk about the Chronicles of Narnia, which I think is actually inappropriate. It's not an allegory in the sense of different characters standing for different abstract ideas, which is what allegory means. It's not the White Witch isn't an allegory. You know, Edmund and Lucy and Peter, they're not allegories. They don't stand for something else. You know, they're characters in this story. But what Lewis is doing, he was also, in his depiction of Aslan, attempting to write myth. And I think that he also achieved that on many occasions. You know, I think of, for instance, for people who know the Chronicles of Narnia, probably my favorite mythic Aslan moment is the de-dragoning of Eustace in the Voyage of the Don Treader, when Eustace is turned into a dragon, and there's this sort of baptismal moment at this fountain where Aslan takes Eustace from being a dragon and turns him back into a boy. In that moment, in that story, in that episode, Lewis is really able to capture an idea, a really profound idea, and illustrate it mythically through this story in a way which is deeply moving even to people who have never thought about the theology involved, have no interest in thinking about the theology involved, but nevertheless, it's really powerful and it's really moving. That's what myth does. That's how myth captures people. But pagan mythology has an enormous role in the Chronicles of Narnia because he felt that that was important. That's why you get all of these characters who are drawn directly from other mythologies, fauns and dwarfs and giants and witches and Father Christmas, Santa Claus, for crying out loud. You know, these are all different mythic figures whom Lewis is bringing together, and he's trying through Narnia to sort of show what is behind them and what they trying to illustrate some of the things that they are pointing to.
This brings up this kind of interesting irony, and I hate to break in here, but I want to do shift this back to Tolkien. But
yeah,
that
yeah.
There's this really interesting irony is that Tolkien becomes very instrumental in converting C.S. Lewis from what you just told me. But it's Christians who today just embrace C.S. Lewis. He's our guy, right? He's the guy who writes the stories in Narnia, becomes celebrated in Christian circles and all of that. But there's still a lot of people that, especially in evangelical Christian circles, look at Tolkien and The Hobbit and they're saying, ah, that's a little bit too pagan. Don't let my kids touch that stuff because that'll contaminate them. And what's going on there?
Yeah, that is a traditional idea. I mean, the root as far as what is being perceived, the reason, I think, why those two authors are perceived so differently, even though they're quite similar, you know, in many of these ways, is that it's all about the outlook that the two of them had, that is, that Tolkien and Lewis had towards evangelism, essentially. C.S. Lewis, when he did convert to Christianity, became an Anglican, and Tolkien, of course, was a Catholic. Tolkien was a pre-Vatican II Catholic, I would emphasize. And one of the things that this meant is that Tolkien was very uncomfortable with C.S. Lewis's apologetic efforts. When C.S. Lewis begins to publish Mere Christianity and you know, the Screwtape Letters, which Lewis actually dedicated to Tolkien, with which Tolkien was uncomfortable.
Mm.
In fact, I rather suspect C.S. Lewis did that for a joke. But anyway, when C.S. Lewis starts publishing all of this Christian doctrine stuff, when Lewis was publishing that, Tolkien was getting uncomfortable with that. And he had conversations like, why are you doing... You're a layman. Leave this to the priests. This is not your job. In that way, Tolkien was a very traditional Catholic and saying, look, lay people have one job, priests have another job. You are crossing the line. Like, you're an amateur. What are you doing? Leave this to the priests. Lewis's response to Tolkien was, the minute the priests actually step forward and start doing this work, I'll leave them to it. But since they're not, somebody's got to do it. So I'm going to.
A very Protestant answer.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. And so this is one of the ways in which the differences between them as Protestant and Catholic became really prominent and really did actually put some strain on their relationship in their later years. But anyway, that difference in attitude can, I think, be seen fairly clearly in their fiction. When you compare the Chronicles of Narnia and Tolkien's works, Lewis is in fact very interested in very actively illustrating Christian ideas. He wanted to take this idea of the Son of God and the Incarnation and God's relationship with people and Jesus' relationship with people and Jesus' significance, and he wanted to illustrate that. Again, taking that supposition, let's make him a lion in this alternate world and then show what happens and show how he relates to people. He is, in fact, trying to make these ideas comprehensible and accessible, to people. Tolkien was never really seeking to instruct in that way. His works are very profoundly Christian. I certainly believe that. He said once in a letter to a friend of his who is a priest that he did not believe that there was anything in his works that was not consistent with an Orthodox belief in the Trinity. But you see, in that letter, he was addressing exactly the concerns that you raised. I mean, there were priests who were friends of his family who were clearly concerned, who read his works and were like, you know, this sounds kind of pagan, really. Yeah. And he was basically reassuring them, no, it's not. And he would sort of explain the things that kind of were underlying that. But I think, again, it's about, for him, he was not really focused at all upon, he wasn't thinking about, like, the spiritual instruction of people. He was writing these stories which were very profoundly informed by his beliefs, both by his Catholic values and his Catholic theology, but he was not making any effort to proselytize in doing it. And so, therefore, it's really hard to read the Chronicles of Narnia unless you are very ignorant of Christianity. You can't really read the Chronicles of Narnia and not realize that there's some Christian stuff going on here. With The Lord of the Rings, it's very easy to read them and not have any suspicion that there's Christian stuff going on here. And many people do. Yeah. But again, I think that Tolkien was much more, content that should be so. He wasn't trying to instruct. But again, his world is really informed by it. What I mean by that is basically in the two things that I just pointed to, both in the theology and in the value structure, the sort of the moral structure, it is very much that most of the values and virtues in Tolkien's world are Christian values and virtues. I say most because there certainly we do see some moments where things which were considered virtues and things which were valued by many of the pagan writers and stories that Tolkien loved so much are also championed. Things like the kind of bravery and even what looks like suicidal heroism, which was such a huge part of being a hero in a Germanic culture, we can see that reflected in Tolkien, and that's not a particularly Christian virtue. But nevertheless, with some exceptions, with some additions like that, the values of these stories are Christian values and Christian virtues. The theology is very Christian. But wait, there's no God, there's no Jesus, there's no Aslan. No, of course there isn't. Because, again, Tolkien wasn't doing that. Tolkien was not doing the kind of supposition that Lewis was doing. But if you read The Silmarillion, where Tolkien actually talks more explicitly about the God and the sort of the mythology that lies behind the history of Middle-earth, you see it very much more clearly. I would recommend to anybody who wants to sort of see more clearly the Christian underpinnings of The Lord of the Rings to read the very first section of The Silmarillion. Mm-hmm. It's very short. It's like 15 pages long. It's called the Ainur Lindele, which means the music of the Ainur. The Ainur are basically the angelic choir. They are these angelic figures who are put in charge of the world. But the work, the Ainur Lindele, begins with Eru, Ilúvatar, who is God, the One. There is, in fact, a monotheistic God an omnipotent monotheistic God who rules over everything and who delegates creation, who creates with and through the angelic choir. And there's very direct and interesting contemplations of the relationship between between providence and free will in the Ina Lindelay. It's one of, I think, one of the most remarkable literary treatments of that subject that I know of, actually. Anyway, you know, once you actually see him doing the, you know, discussing the background theology of the world of Middle-earth, you can see it, it begins to look quite like Christianity. And in fact, there are some places, again, in sort of tangential works, some of which weren't published in his lifetime, where you can see actually there's this this one work that he wrote sort of later on, which actually alludes to the incarnation, has a conversation between an ancient human and an elf who are talking about, they're basically discussing theology and mortality, and they end up actually discussing the incarnation as something which is to come. So, I mean, it's, he clearly saw these things as operating consistently to this, but he was not, he just was not driven by the desire to be illustrating Christian themes. It was not in any way an evangelistic work.
But it's floating there in the background, and I want to bring this back to The Hobbit, because the movie's coming out, and I think
definitely.
The my listeners are going to want to say, oh, you know, there are some Christian themes in here. It might inform their viewing of the movie, or perhaps even going back to look at the book. But I actually have one question about The Hobbit here, and at the beginning of the thing, I said that I never read The Hobbit. I read about a quarter of it, and it just, when I was your age when you first started, maybe I was a little bit older, it just never inspired me. But there's one thing that always stood out, and I'm of Irish heritage, and I'm looking at these Hobbit folks, and I see them in The Lord of the Rings, and they're short, they're roly-poly figures, they live in rolling green hills, and they enjoy their drink many times in excess. was there any kind of connection between Hobbits and the Irish for Tolkien?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
He mostly associated. Well, he was himself. He grew up in the East Midlands, so you know, the England just to the west side of the Welsh border. He was like the general Birmingham area was where he was from. When he thought about the Shire, he sort of said that he was, when he described the Shire, he was kind of picturing in the English countryside of his childhood.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very much, the Hobbits do very much capture a sort of a kind of fictionalized view of, you know, sort of English, you know, British country life at that time, which I think, you know, might well be just as applicable to, you know, to the Welsh and Irish as to the English. But no, I don't think he was thinking of the Irish. He actually didn't say all that much about, he talks about the Welsh much more than he talks about the Irish, because of course he grew up right next to Wales, so sort of Wales was a more of a kind of a feature in his life than Ireland. He didn't really talk about them all that much. I don't think it's Irish specifically, but definitely sort of rural British of like the late Victorian period was what he he described.
Yeah. Okay. So on with the themes of these, the religion in The Hobbit. So we've understood that they're not Irish Catholics necessarily, but nonetheless, he's a Catholic, and he's got these Catholic ideas rolling around the back of his head. But he's still writing about mythology. Nonetheless, the stuff that's in your head is, you know, inevitably going to come out on the page in some form or another. And as we were setting up this interview, one of the things that you mentioned in, when I asked you this was, well, are there Christian themes or are there Christian virtues that really come out here in The Hobbit? And you mentioned three things. You mentioned providence, fate, and free will. So let's go ahead and cover those in order there. And let's start with providence. You know, what do you mean by providence? Why is it important to Christians? And how does it come out in The Hobbit?
Okay. Well, I'm going to rely for my definitions here. Let me reveal my sources first. I'm going to be relying for definitions here on the definitions of those three terms, providence, fate, and free will, given by Boethius in the Consolation of Philosophy, the Latin work that was written in the 4th century, and which was, though almost nobody reads it anymore, was one of the most influential works in the Christian world, possibly still in the top five most influential works in the history of Christianity. Though most people, as I say, don't read it now. But the Consolation of Philosophy is an incredible work, And Tolkien knew it. It informed, like, almost all of medieval literature. So I'm going to be relying on Boethius here for my definitions, because his are some of the most influential ideas on this subject throughout the period in which Tolkien was most interested. Okay, so providence. Providence, then, I would when I use that term, I am meaning the overall plan of God. The difference between providence and fate is sort of a in some ways, a kind of a technical difference. That is, in one sense, there are two different ways of looking at the same thing. The way that Boethius described this was that providence is the unified plan of God, that when God creates the world, he doesn't just create the world in space, he creates it in time. That is, the creation implies not only the, you know, sort of manufacture of the material world, but it also involves the scope of the entire history of the world from beginning to end. All of those things are encapsulated in the moment of creation. God sees and knows all of these things. So there is a plan. God is seeing things. The metaphor, or the simile actually, that Boethius uses is that God is like one who is up in a high tower looking at the land all about, can perceive everything at once, both in space and time, and has all of these things in the perfect and unified purpose of his mind. That is God's providence. So God's plan is providence. Fate is what we call God's plan when it hits the road. That is, when God's plan actually enacts things in history. When we see things occur which were in providence, we call it fate. So fate is the working out of providence in time. Free will, the will of people, then, you know, this is the question. It's sort of the culminating question of the Consolation of Philosophy. The book is called The Consolation of Philosophy because it's a sort of a fictional and allegorical dialogue between Boethius himself, he is the main character of the book, and Lady Philosophy, this allegorical abstraction of wisdom and philosophy herself, who appears at his bedside and has this dialogue with him back and forth. So the Boethius character in the dialogue is very concerned as he follows Philosophy's line of reasoning to the end, and she's talking about providence and faith and all of these things, and he's very concerned that this seems to absolutely preclude any idea of the freedom of the human will, that therefore, if everything is working out according to God's plan, and if all things were foreseen by him, then there must actually not be any freedom of the will, the freedom of the will that we perceive, that we make choices, and those choices have consequences, and they could have been different, is actually an illusion. And Lady Philosophy shows him that that is not the case. So that's what I mean by, when I talk about free will, therefore, I mean the idea that a human choice, that a human will can make choices which actually impact things, which are not prescripted from the beginning. We are not merely robots who are acting things out automatically. The choices that we make actually have an impact, and the story will go differently one way or the other depending on how we act. That is the concept of free will. So, how are these ideas raised in The Hobbit? One of the things that happens over the course of the book is that, especially about halfway through the book, the narrator starts drawing attention to the fact that all these things keep happening by luck. This concept of luck becomes something the narrator keeps coming back to. It doesn't just start in the middle of the book. It begins happening early on in chapter 2 when they, by luck, happen across these magic swords in the trolls' cave when they defeat these trolls, and then they end up getting discover. Well, I'll get back to the map in a second. Anyway, Bilbo turns out is very lucky, and he keeps being saved by luck and all. And so the narrator refers to these things which are happening just by fortune. That is to say, not as a consequence of his action or anything about him, just something which fortuitously occurs. And at first, it just kind of seems like a thing, you know, like, oh, well, wasn't that lucky? Okay, well, that's kind of a fairly simple narrative technique, but it keeps happening and keeps happening until the narrator begins to draw even more attention to it. And when he is, for instance, trying to break the dwarves out of the dungeons of the Elven King in Mirkwood, later on in the book, in chapter 9, which is about halfway through the book, You know, the narrator starts saying things like, luck of an unusual kind was with Bilbo that night, or, you know, that he had always had more than his share of luck. That it begins to sound like some kind of force, some kind of conspiracy, that, like, stuff keeps happening in order to facilitate, in order to save them, in order to facilitate their journey. Things appear to be fated, or rather, so that's where I would say we can see fate happening. That just, like, this stuff keeps happening, which is beyond their control, but it seems to conspire to bring about this particular course of events. That's where I would say that we can see fate happening in the book. Mm-hmm. The evidence of providence is when you sort of start to step back. The narrator, a couple times, kind of pans back and gives us a glimpse of the bigger scene and shows us that, in fact, the events that have occurred, the sort of serendipitous adventures that they have had over the course of their story, have seemed to be conspiring oddly in a particular direction. That is, they're trying to cross the Misty Mountains, for instance, in Chapter 4, but they get waylaid. They have a serious problem, which is that they're camping at night in a cave, and they're captured by goblins and put in chains and hauled down to the goblin stronghold under the Misty Mountains, and this seems like a singularly unfortunate turn of events. But then they manage to escape, and after they escape, they emerge from the other side of the mountains. But they've been now taken way out of their path. They're far further. They're nowhere near where they had planned to come over the mountains, because they had known, or they thought they had known, that path that they were following over the mountains was the only safe path and would lead them to the only road that would take them through Mirkwood. Well, after they're diverted, they discover later on by Bjorn, the bear man, the sort of the werebear who happens to live near where they come out of the mountains, he tells them, oh, yeah, actually, that path you were following, turns out that path is terrible now. It's almost impassable now. Since you've come this way, it's fallen completely into disuse, and you would never have gotten far had you stayed on that path. So it turns out that their apparent misfortune turns out to be singularly fortunate in the end. So he puts them on the right path. Now, this is the forest road. This is the only way that is now reliably will take you through Mirkwood. So, fortunately, they're put on that road. So they go down that road, and then more misfortune strikes them. They leave the path. They are captured by the elves and thrown into the elves' dungeon, and the only way that they can get out is for Bilbo to pack them into barrels, and they end up floating down the river in the famous barrel escape that Bilbo orchestrates from the Elven King's Hall, which was, of course, facilitated by that luck of an unusual kind that I was describing earlier. Mm-hmm. So they come out by barrel, and they're floating down the river towards Lake Town, and the narrator pauses and tells us, oh, by the way, that forest road that Bjorn had put them on, that they were traveling down, that they left and got captured from, well, turns out that would have led them to disaster, too, and that in the end, this path that they have taken, floating down the river in barrels, turns out to be the only way, the unique safe path to Lake Town. It is the only way they could possibly have come there. Mm-hmm. So again, it turns out that this thing, which appeared to be a great misfortune, they're getting lost in Mirkwood and subsequently captured by spiders and then elves, turns out to have been singularly fortunate, actually, and it begins to seem even more clearly that things are unfolding due to some plan that they don't really know about and don't necessarily have access to, but that there is something actually orchestrating events. And Gandalf, on the very last page of the book, talks about that with Bilbo and says that there were these prophecies. And I won't talk about prophecy too much, though that's something that becomes a bigger theme. The idea of luck and things happening by luck actually kind of merges into more sort of supernatural manifestations. We begin to see actual prophecies fulfilled. And, you know, by what appear to be supernatural means. And Bilbo is sort of kind of joking about that, all these prophecies that were made, they appear to have come true, don't they? And Gandalf says to him, don't disbelieve the prophecies just because you yourself had a hand in bringing them about.
Aha! Free will.
He says, now, you don't think, do you, that all of your adventures and escapes were arranged for your sole benefit? He says, you are a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I am very fond of you, but you are only a little person in a wide world, after all. To which Bilbo, with excellent hobbit humility, responds, thank goodness, and passes him the tobacco jar, and that's the last line of the book. Bilbo's choices, of course, have been very important. And the other thing that the narrator has been emphasizing is Bilbo's own development as a character and how he has been coming to make more and more choices which are having more and more significance and indeed do determine the outcome of events. And yet, having done that and having been through that, when again the narrator kind of pans, and this time in the conversation between Gandalf and Bilbo, we're invited to kind of step back and look at the bigger picture, we see, as Bilbo is being instructed, that all of those choices that he made and all of those things that he did by his own free will, these choices that he made, turns out were also a part of this larger plan that in which he had been swept up. So was the, you know, the death of the dragon and the reestablishment of the kingdom under the mountain and everything that happens at the end of the book, were those things destined? Were those things ordained by fate? Were they, you know, preconceived by providence? Yes, they clearly were. They had been prophesied. They had been predicted that it was going to happen, and it, in fact, did happen, as the prophecies foretold. But did those things come about because of what Bilbo did? Would they not have happened had he chosen differently? Yes. His choices indeed were important, and the outcome of events was very largely influenced by Bilbo, by the choices of Bilbo and of others.
It's fascinating insights that you bring to this, because you put your finger on one of the difficulties that I always struggle with in my Christian faith is the issue of providence and free will, and I can never really wrap my head around this. But, you know, as I hear you talk about this, I'm now getting very excited about seeing the movie and watching for these themes, because there is that depth of theology that's not there explicitly, but it's a constant theme throughout human life, and one that plays out in many different forms. And this is really interesting.
It's very cool, you know. And I won't try to really do justice to Boethius's reconciliation of free will and predestination that I believe Tolkien was following. I see a lot of evidence in the way that The Hobbit plays out, and in the way we see in things like the Aina Lindaway that I mentioned before, that he's following Boethius's conception there. But basically, you know, what Lady Philosophy says is the problem is that we imagine God knowing and foreknowing things and foreordaining things. We think about God from a human point of view. That is, with us, the two things would have to be, if we're planning something, if we are ordaining something, if we're making something happen, then it can't also be true that it was caused to happen by something else, like it has one cause or the other. But with God, that's not the case. When God foresees things, in saying that God foresees the future, we are placing God within time. We are imagining God sitting in the past, looking forward to the future, and saying, that's going to happen. And what Lady Philosophy points out to Boethius is that is not true of God. God is outside of time. God is not limited by time. God sees the present and the future in exactly the same way. And so the comparison that she makes, you know, she says, okay, if you see somebody walk into a room and sit down in that chair, and you are 100% sure that your sight is accurate and everything, then you can say, you know, so if you see somebody sitting down, then it is necessary. It is a 100% necessity that that person must sit in that chair. Now, that person chose to sit in that chair. But if you were God and you were looking into tomorrow, just like you're looking into today, you see that person sitting in that chair tomorrow. So if God spoke to that person today and said, you're going to sit in that chair tomorrow, he wouldn't be, it doesn't mean that he's causing, it doesn't mean that person is a robot walking over to that chair. God is looking at that person sitting in the chair. So just as when you see somebody, you're not a cause, you're not causing the thing to happen that you perceive. But nevertheless, the perception is different. It's all about how Boethius is, there's this long and complicated argument, which I'm, of course, doing no justice to, where Lady Philosophy says God's mode of knowledge is fundamentally different from the human mode of knowledge and perception. God is outside of time, and the mode of knowledge is totally different. So we have this problem. We think that there must be a contradiction between fate and free will, between providence and free will, because we are thinking that God is thinking and knowing things like a person would think and know things. But that is not how God thinks and knows things. And that both of those things can happen, can actually be very easily reconciled if we get past that idea. And so that it can be equally true that, because of course if you were able to just look into tomorrow, as you can look into today, and see somebody doing a thing, well, you know that that person is going to choose that thing. Not because you're causing it, but because you see it. It is to you a fact. All of history is unfolded before you at one time. And so, therefore, that choice itself is integrated into the providential plan before creation, because it's all there.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, that's basically Boethius' argument. And I think that we can see that being illustrated throughout The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings as well. We see this come up on several occasions in The Lord of the Rings. In fact, Tolkien alludes to this kind of thing even more explicitly in The Lord of the Rings than he does in The Hobbit.
Yeah, so this has been a great discussion. It's really given me an opportunity to think more about the forthcoming movie and go back and watch the Lord of the Rings trilogy and maybe even read the books. You know, maybe I'll do that. But
I would encourage that.
Okay.
Because I have to say, I am not sure. This is one of my top questions about the film is what, if anything, they're going to do with this, how they're going to handle this element. I could easily see them, you know, skimming over it pretty easily. How the films treated these kinds of sort of theological or philosophical ideas of Tolkien, it's not that they stripped them. There are some people who are, you know, some Tolkien scholars and, you know, some like dedicated Tolkien people who are very anti-movie. And one of the things that some of these people say, as Christopher Tolkien himself recently said in an interview, that he felt like the movies and the whole cultural phenomenon that has followed the movies has really sort of stripped The Lord of the Rings of all of its sort of philosophical power. I don't agree with that. I don't believe that that is true. But nevertheless, there's no question about the fact that the kind of theological and philosophical statements that the films of The Lord of the Rings make are not the same ones as the ones that the books make. And I think that we can see some significant difference in the whole sort of worldview that underlies the films compared to the books. So I'm not sure that they're going to do this, that they're going to, you know, how they're going to handle this, and in particular, whether they play up or play down the prophecy stuff. I would suspect they're going to have to do one or the other, because exactly this kind of very subtle, occasional reference to it, make one allusion, ask us to kind of look back over things and put things together the way that Tolkien does it in the book. Very effective in a written story. That kind of thing doesn't come across very well in films. I mean, either they're going to have to play it up or they're going to have to play it down. And I'll be interested to see which they do. That's what I would think. They would have to do one or the other, and I'll be interested to see which one they do. I suspect they're going to play it down, but I'm not sure.
Are you getting excited about the movie coming up?
I am. Yeah, I've been anticipating this for a long time, and I will say that I have been really impressed with everything I've seen so far. From everything that I've seen, the evidence suggests to me that they have, from a pure, I'm not talking about, you know, their cinematography or anything else, I'm just thinking from the point of view of a Tolkien person, they seem to have done their homework more thoroughly with The Hobbit even than they did with The Lord of the Rings. They did a good job. I don't agree with every decision they made. But you know, I don't like everything about the movies, but they did do a good job and they made good movies. I think that they've done more work. They've been more thoughtful in integrating Tolkien's thought and Tolkien's work in the Hobbit films, based on what I've seen so far, than I saw in The Lord of the Rings. So I'm excited about that. I think it's going to be very interesting.
Well, they did their homework, and we have spent our time here for the past hour doing our homework with Corey Olson. He's done a fantastic job of enlightening us to all these various themes in The Hobbit, as well as J.R.R. Tolkien's life. And so I want to remind our listeners to, if they want to do further homework and investigate this further, please pick up his book, Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. We'll link to that on our website. And also visit his website, the Mythgard Institute. So if there are questions that you still have lingering in your mind, that's a great place to go and answer them. And thus we end. And I say to you, Corey Olson, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.